This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project, and today is May 14th, 1997. I'm at the home of Professor Mark Eccles, and we're continuing our interview, which we started a week ago today. Dr. Eccles, you mentioned before the interview that there were a few things you wanted to tie up from last week's session.
Yes. I want to talk about a few more friends like Bob DeRemus, who went to war and then came back and was associate dean under Mark Ingram, a very effective dean and associate dean. Unfortunately, he never smoked himself, but he died of lung cancer because he just had to go to so many committee meetings and inhale the smoke from other smokers who did. And then there was Edgar Lacey, who came from Vanderbilt and was a very good teacher and effective administrator. He was director of freshman English for many years and also associate chairman of the department. And he died finally after shoveling snow one winter.
Oh, my.
So, unfortunately.
Now, what did he teach?
He taught contemporary literature, and he was a very hard worker as an administrator. A good deal of his time was spent directing freshman English. We had more and more teaching assistants. Then in the 60s, we had the excellent chairman of Helen White, the first woman chairman, and Walter Rideout, the first chairman whose field was American literature. And Walter, in the 60s, divided the English department into seven groups, divisions. And one was medieval, one Renaissance, one 17th and 18th century, one 19th century, one American, and then there was one in English language, history of the English language. Then in the...
Did that replace... Had it just been one department up to that point?
No, it was all one department still, but we had more meetings of the people in our own, related fields, as well as the department. The chairmen were chosen by the whole department, and when the chairmen were chosen in 1968, there were an even number of votes for Carl Kroeber and for me. I think in normal times I was told I would have been chairman, but we had added so many young professors that it made a very even division. The university had grown tremendously during the 1960s. For instance, we had new professors in 1965, Merton Seeltz in American Literature, an expert on Melville and Emerson, Lawrence Dembo, who edited contemporary literature, that was his field, the 20th century American. Jerome Taylor from Chicago was the chairman of the medieval division.
He was a Chaucer scholar, wasn't he?
Chaucer and medieval literature. And Phil Harth also came from the University of Chicago, was a very good scholar in 17th and 18th century. He's now at the Institute of Humanities in Madison, part-time. So we had so many new people that when the teacher strike came, it didn't affect me greatly, but you could hear from the open windows in the classroom the teachers, demonstrators going around Bascom and howling, "Shut it down, shut it down." And there were a few bomb threats, but nothing really happened. So we had all classes just the same as usual.
Now, was this sort of a division emerging between what's normally generally called the Young Turks and the Old Turks?
The Young Turks and the Establishment.
Established Turks.
Establishment, yes.
And so Kroeber's faction more or less represented the Young Turks.
Yes, that's right.
And they were trying to usurp the power. This is sort of a Richard
III movie. They said the older generation had run everything, and now they showed how it ought to be done. Anyway, the result was that Dean Epstein called us both in and talked it over with us, and he said the only thing is to choose someone who's not involved with either side. Henninger has only been here for 2 years, and he agreed to accept it for 2 years. He stood the heat for 2 years, and then he left for a position at the University of British Columbia. He was a good scholar, but it was a very difficult position during the 60s to 1970, when the bombing of Sterling, Sterling Hall occurred.
Well, let's talk for just a moment about Henninger, because he's kind of a lost figure here. He was only at the university for 4 years, yet he played a very pivotal role for for those 2 years. First of all, what was his field?
Field was Spencer. He had been teaching at Duke, and he came to Madison as a very great addition to our scholarly faculty in Spencer. We had had Merritt Hughes in Milton and others in Chaucer, but we had no distinguished person at that time in Spencer. So he did a good job as far as anyone could at that time, but I think it was really an impossible situation.
Was it stressful on him, do you recall?
Oh, I think so, yes. He tried to please everybody, you know, and brought students to department meetings to tell us what to do. And we got a little annoyed with the students taking over our department.
So this was, I've heard that this was going on in other departments in the humanities
I'm sure it was. And it may have affected other departments, but the chairmanship finally settled down after that, and we had a very good chairman by the time I retired, Charles Scott in English language.
In hindsight, what are your feelings? Would you have liked to have been chair during
No, I wouldn't. Time? I was very glad I didn't have to serve as chairman. I would have done it if asked, but I was much happier doing my teaching and my research. And I kept doing the same teaching in Shakespeare and Elizabethan drama and some courses in 20th century English and literature. And what I really enjoyed was being chairman of the Humanities Division for 3 years, from 69 to 72. That gave me the opportunity to work with such good scholars as Germaine Bray in French, Lloyd Caston in Spanish, Tom Shaw in Slavic languages, and Bill Hay in philosophy. And we all got on very well together because we were the older generation and we knew what we wanted. Our responsibility was to recommend promotions to tenure, which had been sent up from the departments, and new courses, which also the department wished to teach. And then we sent those on to the dean and dean of the graduate school. We had very good associate deans who worked really with the humanities. The dean of the graduate school was always a scientist, but we had Homer Harriot in Spanish and then Ian Lorem in German, who were very nice persons to work with. So I liked that, and I also liked the Committee on Fellowships and Scholarships of the graduate school, and that gave us a chance to talk over the best students in each field and see how many fellowships we could award.
Well, that must have been gratifying.
That was great fun.
Getting back to the divisional committee for a second, everything was so politically divided for a while on campus. The recommendations that came to you for tenure, were politics involved?
No, I don't think so. The departments in the humanities at least, were choosing the best scholars and teachers. I think we agreed very well together. We had no great divisions in the humanities committee.
Going back even one step further, you said you could hear the people outside the classrooms chanting and whatnot. Did you ever were your classes ever interrupted?
No. There were bomb threats which terrified some of the students, but all our classes met and nothing actually really happened in the English department.
As long as we're on the topic of the student unrest, can you describe for me your reaction to Sterling Hall? Can you remember clearly what was going on at that point?
Well, at that time I was on vacation in Canada, and I remember reading about it in the papers as I sat beside a quiet lake in Banff, Canadian Rockies. So I was just very glad I wasn't in Madison at that time.
As a matter of fact, I've been in Banff, and I can't think of a place that could be more different from what was going on in Madison.
It was a very blessed relief from being at the hotbed in Madison. Yes.
Were you terribly surprised that that had happened?
No, I didn't expect it, but it came as a result of all the agitation. There had been threats of bombs, and this is one that actually killed a researcher in physics.
Do you feel that things changed after the bombing on campus?
Yes, I think so. After that, the Vietnam War came to an end, and the agitation seemed to settle down. Mm-hmm. I don't think it had any permanent results. It was an unfortunate period of unrest in the academic community, not only here but all over the country, from Harvard to Berkeley.
Now, we managed to get off. You started off by talking about Edgar Lacey and Bob Doremus. Was there anyone else that you wanted to mention?
Yes, I think outside the English department, my best friend was John Orsini, who came from the University of Florence, Italy, to be chairman of comparative literature. And he and his wife, Margaret, who was a professor of medicine, American, and my wife and I went out to dinner a great many weekends, and I remember going to Italian restaurants like Portobello and Troia's and Namio's, and Joe Namio always greeted Jan as il professore. We had great, very good times together.
Now, there was still the Little Italy. There was a Little Italy around when you were.
Yes, around Park Street.
The Greenbush area.
Greenbush, yes.
Were there a lot of Italian restaurants?
Some of the restaurants, like Namio's, were down on Park Street, a little further down on Park Street, yes. Troia's had been on State Street, but he moved out a little further out of town.
So, anyone besides?
Well, I was a very good friend of Ronald Mitchell. He came to direct the University Theater in 1937. And I remember especially his productions of King Lear, in which Fred Cassidy played Edmund and King John, and the rollicking humor of Kiss Me, Kate, based on The Taming of the Shrew, and Juno and the Peacock by Shauna Casey. He gave very good productions. The university students had given, before there was a university theater, they had used churches to put on Marlowe's Dr. Faustus and Eliot's Murder in the Cathedral, which I think was one of the very first productions.
I believe
of
it
that
was the
play.
American premiere.
I think it was.
I think Hayakawa was involved in that, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, right. And Hayakawa was a brilliant tempter, one of the four tempters of Thomas à Becket. Ah. And I remember Hayakawa very well. At that time, he had just finished his PhD and was teaching at the university. And later, of course, he became senator from California, president of the San Francisco University.
Well, what was he like? He's a fairly famous, he became a famous figure.
He was probably the most famous graduate of the PhD of the English department for political reasons rather than for his. He was a very interesting person. He was a very capable scholar, and he wrote on American literature, and he seemed to get on well with everybody, yes.
Now, he went into semantics later on, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He did.
I seem to have remembered reading his textbook in college.
He wrote a book, Language in Action.
That's it.
One of the options for freshman teachers was Language in Action. And Hayakawa was the expert on that. And he was undoubtedly the best known of our PhDs.
Now, let me ask you this. He became well-known, and depending on how you want to look at that, he was not very popular in some circles, in others he was. When he left here, would you have envisioned him moving on to...
No. I had no idea of him having any connection with any political action. After all, he was Japanese, he came from Canada, he was different from us, but he was a very friendly, intelligent person.
You were talking about Roland Mitchell's wonderful productions and the Faustus was done in the church. What was the university theater like during those years?
Well, the theater at the Union Theater opened with Alfred Lunt and Len Fontanne giving The Taming of the Shrew in 1939.
Did you go to the opening?
Oh, yes.
Oh, tell me about the opening for a moment.
I went to every play that the Lunts who lived in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, liked to come over because Madison was a drive and they could go home after the play. So we didn't see them personally, but we saw them on the stage and admired them greatly when there was a biography of Lunt, I wrote the author, and told me more about the plays that I had seen. We saw most of them at the Union Theater, but we also drove to Milwaukee to see The Visit by Duren Matten, which they gave a very serious German play translated. And the university had other productions. I had acted at Oberlin as Touchstone in As You Like It, and in 1954 I enjoyed playing Jaques in As You Like It for the Madison Civic Theater, and that was a town group, which is now the Madison Theater Guild, mm-hmm. but at that time was called the Madison Civic Theater. So that was my one one participation. It took a good deal of time, so usually I was just a playgoer.
Yeah.
We had fun driving, however, to Milwaukee to see all the plays of the Milwaukee Repertory Theater and a good many operas such as Barber Seville and Don Giovanni, Lucia de Lammermoor and Tosca. And then we drove to Minneapolis to the Guthrie, mm-hmm. Guthrie Theater because they had excellent productions of The Duchess of Malfi by Webster, The Way of the World by Congreve, and more modern plays such as Ibsen's Hedda Gabler and Strindberg's Dance of Death. So that was excellent theater too. Probably the best Shakespeare we saw was at the Shakespeare Festival in Stratford, Ontario. And we went there many summers and saw plays of which I particularly liked Antony and Cleopatra with Christopher Plummer and mm-hmm. Zoe Caldwell. And Maggie Smith played Macbeth and Beatrice in Much Ado About Nothing.
Well, I might have been sitting with you in the audience those nights because I saw her as Lady
Good.
Macbeth and
Good.
And Beatrice.
Yes.
Now, do I remember you telling me, or did I dream this, when we met for the first time, that you had gone to the first season at Stratford in Ontario?
Not the first season, no. But from 65 on, we went to five different summer seasons. Now, we had, of course, seen a great deal of Shakespeare in London in the 30s. We saw especially the famous Old Vic productions and Sadler's Wells, and then we saw in the summer, we saw outdoor Shakespeare on the Regent's Park outdoors. I remember one of the performances of The Tempest had an actual thunderstorm which sent all the actors and audience under a roof pavilion away from The Tempest. But we had other places in England to see plays. Malvern Festival had a wonderful series of five centuries of English plays from Everyman and Elizabethan Tragedy through Restoration Comedy and 18th Century Comedy to the latest play by Shaw. And there I had a chance to hear Shaw talk about his favorite subject, the need for a national theater, which finally came to mm-hmm. pass in the 60s.
Did he give a lecture?
He was giving a lecture on it, yes.
How was he? What was your impression?
Oh, he was very interesting. He was always provocative, always very interesting. And he reminded me somewhat of Kittredge with his white beard by that time. they were imposing personalities. In our years in London, I also saw the Passion play at Oberammergau in 1930 and again in 1934. I saw in Venice Alexander Moisi acting Everyman in German and a Goldoni comedy in Italian. And I saw Molière's Bourgeois Gentleman at the Comédie Française in Paris. We also had visits to the Edinburgh Festival, which had a very fine Scottish play, and to the Abbey Theatre in Dublin, where we saw The Playboy of the Western World.
Oh, nice place.
So we had seen a great many plays from the 30s on in England and elsewhere.
Now, I haven't thought about the Passion play at Oberammergau in years. That's the one that goes on for several days?
And yes.
The village people?
Well, no, it runs for about 8 hours in one day.
Oh.
But it was given first in 1634, and in 1934 they were celebrating the 300th anniversary, given by the townsmen, mm-hmm. The carpenters and workmen of Oberammergau, one of whom Alexis Lang was a carpenter, but very famous as playing the role of Christ. Mm. And the next most important role was Judas Iscariot. Mm-hmm. But that was very interesting because it was a beautiful town in Bavaria, and it was very interesting to see these ordinary German people playing the roles which they had played for many years.
Yeah, I seem to remember my old German teacher in high school, who was from Germany, saying that these people really grew into those roles.
Yes.
They grew their beards.
They did.
They began
to look like the characters of the first century.
You were going to mention Wallace Stegner.
Yes. Wallace was here only 2 years as instructor in English, from 37 to 39. His novel, Crossing to Safety, is centered upon characters based on Stegner and his wife, who came from the West, and their great friendship with two people who came from the East, Phil Gray, an instructor in English from Yale, and his wife, who was the daughter of a Yale professor.
Now, they were the people who were in your play reading group or your poetry?
Yes,
group?
They were.
Yeah.
We knew them all very well.
Okay.
We went on picnics together to Pine Bluff and other places in Dane County. I remember we had the Stegners to dinner one Sunday, and we talked about American folk songs. One of his novels was called Big Rack Candy Mountain, which was the title of an American folk song. And I remember also a Christmas party where we all sang Christmas carols. And the hostess asked the three of us to sing solos as the three kings who came to Nazareth. And so Phil Gray, I remember, sang Gold I Bring, and I sang Frankincense to Offer Have I, and
yes.
Wallace Stegner sang Myrrh I Bring,
yeah.
With bitter perfume.
Yeah.
So then everybody joined in the choruses and sang the final stanzas of
Star
that play.
Of Wonder, Star of Bright, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
We liked that very much.
Yeah, I mean,
well, I visited Wallace's classes, and he was a very good teacher, so I was asked to by the chairman, and I reported that he was a good teacher. The reason he didn't stay was because the Grays invited him and his wife to spend the summer with them in Vermont, where they had a summer place. And there they got acquainted with Theodore Morrison of Harvard, who was teaching at the Breadloaf Writers School in Vermont. And after a couple of years, Morrison persuaded Stegner to go to Harvard as a faculty instructor in writing. He stayed there about 6 years during the war, and then Stanford offered him a full professorship, and he became head of their writing program for the rest of his career.
Now, when he was in Madison, I don't know that much about Wallace Stegner. Was he known at all as a writer at that point?
Oh, yes. He had just won a prize from the Atlantic Monthly for a short story. And later he won a Pulitzer Prize. But at that time, he was just a young man who hadn't yet published his novels, but had published short stories, which he'd written when he was at the University of Iowa. He had come from the West and graduated from the University of Utah. He had lived in North Dakota and Saskatchewan, Canada. And so most of his books were written with Western backgrounds, and Crossing of Safety was a contrast between the West and the East. When he first came to Madison, they lived in a basement on the east side of Madison. After they knew the Grays, they moved to Region Allen, two blocks up here. The Grays had a big house on Van Hise Avenue near here. So we saw quite a bit of them, yes.
Mm-hmm. In the Crossing to Safety, so the Easterners were modeled after Gray. Were any other UW figures?
No, I don't think so. He didn't try to bring in the other members of the department. It was concentrating on the couple that came from the West, and admired by the couple who came from the East and who were willing to do anything for them. Mm. And eventually resulted in his going to Harvard before he went to Stanford.
Well, I'm embarrassed to say I've never read that book, and as somebody doing oral history for the University of Wisconsin, I certainly should, so I'll have to check that one out and take a look at it. Last week, after we finished our session, we did talk about one person whose name hasn't come up yet today, and that's the former dean of L&S, George Clark Sellery.
Sellery. I didn't see a great deal of him, but because I was just a young lecturer when I came, the chairman came and introduced me to Sellery, and he said, "You look very young," and I wished later that I had said what William Pitt said when he became Prime Minister of England at 24, "That, sir, is a fault that time will cure." But I didn't think of that at the time. So I only occasionally saw Sellery, and he asked me about Henry Pockman when he was appointed to the English Department. He lived fairly near here too, but he was a much older man than I, so I had only official contacts with him.
Well, you're living, we're on the corner of Regent and Roby. There must have been many, this was a very big university community.
Yes,
right around
University
here.
Heights was founded in the 1890s and opened up to people mostly from the university with a few lawyers and doctors and others. And so we knew quite a few of the people that lived quite near us in English department. Standish Henning still lives a block from us. Herbert Howe and Classics on Chadburn. Other people living fairly close to us on Van Hise. Lowell Frouchy lived in Chadburn too. So many of the members of our play reading group did live rather near to us.
You look at those directories of the faculty before World War II especially, mm-hmm. and they're concentrated. I mean, there wasn't that much beyond here.
Right,
The city ended.
The year we came, the streetcars had just stopped running. They ran out to the Forest Hill Cemetery at the end of at the corner of Regent and the Speedway. And then in 1934, they began having buses instead. And it was easy for us to get downtown by bus.
Do you know why they stopped the streetcars?
Yes, it wasn't being as profitable. The tracks were still in the city streets when we came, and it was some years before they got the Madison Streetcar Railway Company to pay. It was run by a capitalist in New York who had no particular interest in Madison except for making money out of his street railway. But when it stopped being profitable, they found buses ran more often, more easily.
So the last stop on the run was the cemetery. Yeah.
That was the cemetery, yes. Now it goes out to West Town. The buses go out to West Town.
Yeah, very great changes in the city.
Yes. I remember the Poetry Club once met at the first house in University Heights, which was over on Summit Avenue. That was a lawyer who had built way out. It was way out in those days before the streetcar was even extended out Regent Street. It used to go only to the campus, stop at the stadium.
Okay, let's just start over right where you started with your research on Marlowe.
There I had new material, which made a very interesting story to tell. So I was able to write with great freedom about the episodes in his life that I had found out about. Shakespeare was quite different because when I was at Stratford-on-Avon, I went through all the town records of Stratford in Shakespeare's lifetime. And then it mostly concerned Shakespeare's earlier years, his birth and school years and his marriage in Stratford, and then his later years after he retired to Stratford for his last years. And Shakespeare and Marlowe were my major books, but also edited, of course, plays by Shakespeare, Othello and Twelfth Night, Richard III, and Measure for Measure, which took 30 years to finish because it was a very arm edition I had to read every note ever written about the play.
Isn't Richard Knowles working on one of those now?
He is. He finished his As You Like It, which was based on his dissertation at Pennsylvania. He's working on King Lear, which is one of the most interesting complex problems in Shakespeare text. And so he's comparing the version published in the quarto with the version published in the folio, which is quite different, several hundred lines different. So he's also general editor of the Very Arm series and responsible for other editions which are being done of the new Very Arm Shakespeare.
Now you're well known for your biographies, and did you find Shakespeare, there seems to be so many black holes in his life. Was that a frustrating experience for you?
It's frustrating, but I was not going. I was not writing a biography which conjectures about the things that we do not know. But I was giving the things that we do know, and the people of Stratford in his time, the condition of the church and school and prominent citizens. His father was an alderman and at one time the chief officer of Stratford. And we have no personal letters at all by Shakespeare. We have only one letter written which mentions Shakespeare by a friend of his in Stratford. But it is frustrating because there's so much you would like to know, and a serious scholar really has to be patient and put up with what he can find out.
It's amazing how the most important playwright in the history wrote for what, 20 years or something like that, and there's just so little known about his actual career. It's astonishing
That's true.
That he didn't have his Boswell tagging along.
No, we wish he had.
Yeah. So you were looking a lot at the social context of the plays. What England was like and what
England was.
Yeah. When you taught Shakespeare, was this a part of your approach to?
Yes, I was mostly concentrating on the drama and poetry of the plays themselves rather than the background. But everything that needs to be known comes in your course of teaching Shakespeare.
I'm going to ask you one of the corniest questions I've ever asked on an interview in my life, but I have to know. What was your favorite play?
Well,
or what is your favorite play? Excuse me.
That is very hard to say. I think Hamlet is probably really my favorite. When I was interviewed when I retired by the University News Service, I said Falstaff because he's often neglected for the tragedies, and I think he's a great comic figure, Falstaff. I had seen Orson Welles' film called Chimes at Midnight, in which he played Falstaff, as well as his Othello. I saw quite a few Shakespeare plays on film, which I might mention. Mm-hmm. Midsummer Night's Dream in the elaborate production by Max Reinhardt. The Othello of Paul. Paul Robeson actually in Madison play Othello. But the other movie, the best movies, I think, were those of Olivier and Henry V and Hamlet and Richard III.
Have you seen any of the more contemporary Kenneth Branagh productions?
More of what?
Kenneth Branagh's more recent.
Yes, I've seen the Henry V.
Did you? What was your comment on?
Well, it's a different attitude, a different position about war, particularly, and. I think Olivier is the greater one. It was during the war with a great deal of patriotic enthusiasm. But Branagh is a more realistic production, yes.
And a lot of people are calling him sort of the new Olivier, the person that the torch is being passed on to.
Yes.
His Hamlet just came out 6 months ago or so.
Yes.
What about Marlowe? What did you find out about him?
Well, I found out that he was involved in a duel in fields just outside of the city of London, and that he was fighting with a certain William Bradley, a young man. But when his friend Thomas Watson came, Marlowe's friend, Bradley said, "Art thou now come? Then I will have a bout with thee." So he got into the duel, and it resulted in the killing of Bradley by Thomas Watson. This resulted in Marlowe and Watson being held in jail on suspicion of murder, but eventually it was decided by the coroner's jury that it was self-defense, and the Queen gave a pardon to Watson for the killing of Bradley.
How old was Marlowe when this happened?
Marlowe was 29. When
he didn't live very long.
He was himself killed at 29. This was a little earlier than that. He was in his 20s. But he was killed himself in a fight in the tavern with some of his friends who were drinking at Deptford.
Was your first biography was Marlowe? Was the biography of Marlowe?
Yes.
And then Shakespeare came after.
And Shakespeare, yes. After that, I wrote mostly articles. I wrote a great many articles about Ben Jonson, Spencer, and Middleton, George Chapman, and. Even after I retired, I spent most of my time in the winter season in the library and published articles in a good many different journals. One was on 100, what a new facts about 100 authors of the 16th, 17th century in England. One was about the actors that Shakespeare could have known. In his will, he mentions his, among his closest friends, Richard Burbage, who was the leading man in most of his plays, and Heming and Condell, who were actors and who were responsible for publishing the first collected edition of Shakespeare. If they hadn't published their friends' works, we would never have texts of any such plays as Macbeth and Antony and Cleopatra and The Tempest. So it's very fortunate that they did. And up until 1993, I was still publishing articles on Elizabethan actors and authors.
Let's talk a little bit about your teaching. You taught, of course, the Shakespeare. You came and replaced Professor Pyre after he died.
Yes, Shakespeare and Elizabethan drama. We read 23 plays of Shakespeare and the major plays of Marlowe, Ben Jonson.
23 plays in what?
23 plays.
In a semester?
In a year.
In a year.
It was a year course.
That's a lot of plays.
Yes. Madeline concentrated on 6 or 8 plays, and that's what Kittredge had done. She used Kittredge's edition. Mm-hmm. But I like to read more plays and also to have the advantage of reading plays by Marlowe and Jonson and Beaumont, Fletcher, and Webster.
So you read 23 Shakespeare plays.
And a dozen or so other
of
his contemporary plays, yes. One year I was asked to give a seminar, and the seminar usually had about 6 or 8 graduate students. But that year, because it was on Elizabethan drama, I had 36 graduate students in the seminar. There they really had, read rapidly. They didn't have exams, but they had term papers to write. And I had some very good students in those courses.
Did the students like that approach?
Yes, they liked to be able to read as much as possible. The PhD candidates were going to be asked about Shakespeare, which was the one thing everybody had to take a year of in the English department for a degree. So.
And Madeline Doran used that other approach of spending maybe 4 or 5 weeks.
Concentrated on the major tragedies and comedies, yes. Yeah. Yes.
What other courses? Obviously, you taught many other ones.
Yes, I did. I taught freshman English, as everybody except a few did teach. Sophomore literature, at first with Mr. Quintana, later contemporary literature with Mr. Lacey. I lectured sometimes in contemporary literature. For some years, I taught the Romantic poets, the 19th century poets, and I enjoyed those for a change. Occasionally, I filled in with lecturing in Chaucer or the Victorian poets, but my main emphasis was on Shakespeare and Elizabethan drama.
Now, you, in the course of your many years here, you obviously, and you said you taught graduate students, you obviously served as a major professor for several people.
I was major professor for 50 different students, about half women, and among the best women that I had, they went on to teach at the University of Oregon, the University of San Francisco, the Washington State University, in which Sue McLeod is now chairman, and DePaul University in Chicago. Among my best men, some of them went to teach at Michigan State and Northern Michigan, Marquette and St. Olaf's College in Minnesota, Loyola at New Orleans, and the University of South Carolina, where my black student is still teaching. Mm. So I had a lot of very interesting, able students, and I recommended some of them for fellowships at the Folger Shakespeare Library and the Huntington Library. Now, when I was at the Huntington, I had a fellowship in Pasadena in 1939-40, and I read thousands of rare books which were not available in the library at the University of Wisconsin. So I spent most of my time collecting material, but I wrote some articles there, which I later published.
Now, you also, as long as we're into some of your awards and honors, you were a Guggenheim Fellow in 1955.
Yes.
How did that come about?
Well, I was recommended by the people who had known me at Harvard, Kittredge and Lowes, and Robinson and by Charles Sisson from the University of London. And I didn't accept the Guggenheim in 55 because I was offered the Fulbright lectureship at Stratford and Avon. And I wanted to go especially to Stratford and be able to work on Shakespeare. So I enjoyed the year in Stratford very much. And there, I was especially fortunate to see Olivier, who was acting that year in Stratford. Usually he's acted in London, but he was acting Macbeth and Malvolio and Twelfth Night and Titus Andronicus. And John Gielgud came from London and acted a wonderful King Lear and a brilliant Benedick in Much Ado. So we were very fortunate to see the best actors in Shakespeare that year in Stratford.
And what kind of research were you doing in Stratford?
I was doing the life of Shakespeare based on all the town records. Mm-hmm. And I worked there and also in the public record office in London. And I went over every record that survives had anything to do with Shakespeare's life.
Were there pretty many? Were you able to find
Stratford has a very good collection of records, yes. It now belongs to the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust, but it was preserved by the town of Stratford for 300 years. And now there's a special birthplace trust with a library where you can work in more modern conditions. When I worked, it was just a collection of manuscripts.
So you came back and then you took
Then the about the Guggenheim, I couldn't take both the same year, so I asked the opinion of Mark Ingram, and he suggested that I teach 2 years after coming back from Stratford, which I did, and then take the Guggenheim and take leave of absence and use that for my writing up my results about Shakespeare in Warwickshire. So I found the material in Stratford on the Fulbright lectureship, which was actually a research fellowship. Mm-hmm. I was connected with the University of Birmingham, but the Shakespeare Center was in Stratford. And in the Guggenheim I worked on in the university library on the checking everything and looking up all the other literature that involved Shakespeare at that time.
One thing I want to go back to that you were talking about your students, and you said about a little more than half of them were women.
About half, yes.
Again, we get into we talked earlier about how many women there were teaching in the English department. These women, the 50% women that you had, were they spread out pretty much over time? Were you getting a lot of women students early on?
I think there was an increasing number from the 60s on, because the whole university had a tremendous increase in student population. We mentioned the increase after the war, and then in the 60s, by the time of the 60s, the enrollment had got up to 40,000, and they were talking of building a complete new campus, which they fortunately didn't do because it didn't continue after that. The birth rate didn't continue, but it had a tremendous increase, and therefore also a great increase in the number of women. The same thing happened in the Modern Language Association of America, because the enrollment there, the number of members grew up to about 10,000, and there are now probably more women than men professors of English who belong to the Modern Language Association.
Well, you brought that up. Let's talk about the MLA for just a few moments. When did you join, and how long were you active in it?
Well, from the time I came to Madison, I was a member. I was particularly active when I was chosen to chair the Shakespeare group in 1940, and again in 1964. In 1964 was the 300th anniversary of Shakespeare's birth. So I remember asking some very good scholars to give the program on Shakespeare and Marlowe. I asked a professor at Stanford, and I asked Harry Levin from Harvard, who had been probably the most brilliant student I ever read the blue books of, in the Kittredge's Shakespeare at Harvard. Then I was also chairman of the Spencer Group 1 year and chairman of the Elizabethan Group. Usually they met in big cities like New York and Chicago and Washington, which had hotels for a huge number of student people. They always met in the week between Christmas and New Year's for 3 or 4 days. And 2 years they changed their pattern and met in September before the classes began. And 1 year that was in Madison in 57. And that was one of the busiest weeks I ever spent. My daughter was married on Sunday. During the week, I was giving a paper. I was directing a seminar on Shakespeare. And Merritt Hughes was chairman of the local committee, and I was assisting him in making arrangements for all the people who showed up, including many of our former students. The other meeting was at Stanford, and there I had the pleasure of meeting some of my best friends who were teaching in California at the time.
How has you've been with the MLA then since you started in 1935? Has the organization changed much?
It has changed. The emphasis is now more on critical theory and theoretical matters. It used to be more on literary history and factual knowledge.
When did that change take place?
Well, I think in the 60s probably there was a change in the climate of scholarship, and more people were interested in different theoretical approaches.
Was this sort of a reflection of what was going on in the English department here at the same time?
No, I don't think it affected the English department, and I don't think it interests me as much as the discovery of actual new facts and information did. Literary history was essentially my field, rather than critical theory.
Now we all hear about the big pendulum that always, you know, goes back and forth. Are you aware of any indication that there is a shift, or is critical theory sort of?
I don't know. It's such a large organization that I never submitted a paper to MLA because it took years to get published, and I could get my work published in a couple of years from various other journals in England and America. But I was often asked to report on things that were being considered for the Modern Language Association and anything in the Elizabethan field.
Was it as, I mean, obviously it wasn't as large back in 35, but what was the size of it when you first joined? Was it?
I suppose there were about 4,000.
Also, it was still a fairly...
Probably members. Yeah. After all, everybody in the United American colleges tended to belong if they had any interest in scholarship. And some people were from England and other countries.
You were also a member of the International Association of University Professors of
Yes,
English.
That was very interesting because it gave you a chance to meet scholars from England and European countries. Beside the people you already met in meetings at the Modern Language Association in America. There I had a chance to attend the meetings in Dublin and Istanbul, York and Aberdeen particularly. And there I had many pleasant conversations with the scholars that I wouldn't have known otherwise.
Istanbul.
That was very interesting. It gave us a chance to travel with Madeline Doran, and we went around Greece and Turkey, Greece for 10 days and Turkey for about 10 days, going as far as Turkey and Asia and the Black Sea. But Istanbul was very interesting, and we stayed at a fascinating hotel called the Pera Palace right near the Bosphorus, and went to the Topkapi Palace and other places of interest.
Another organization, let's get local here, is the Madison Literary Club.
Yes. I was recommended in 1945 by the director of the State Historical Society at that time, Edward Alexander. He later went to Williamsburg to do research there. But he had known me as in the play reading group, which he had belonged to, and so he proposed me for the literary club, which was limited, I think, to 50 members and their wives. And my wife was secretary of the club for several years, and I served a term as president when it was my turn. There I gave five papers. Did I mention the papers that I gave?
No.
Well, the first was on the Mermaid Tavern, and later ones were on Captain John Smith, a fascinating problem in biography, because he wrote a book about his travels, but people have argued ever since whether they were true travels or partly imaginary, like Munchausen. Anyway, I thought they were probably based on real adventures. He'd fought in Turkey, for instance, and been taken prisoner and escaped from prison. And then in Virginia, he told his story of Pocahontas saving his life when he might have been killed by the Indians. Another was Ben Johnson, giving an account of his very lively life. He also was involved in duels. And then I wrote a paper on my research at the Folger and the Huntington Library. I had done a good deal of work at the Folger Library in Washington. My mother was living in Washington, and when I wanted to do research, I had some time on leave. I would go to Washington and work on my editions of Shakespeare. And then at the Huntington, I had also the year of work there in Pasadena.
Now, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yes.
You said your first one of your papers was on the Mermaid Tavern. That's in the one in Rye, England?
No, it's it was in London, in the city of London. There is a mermaid in Rye, but it was a very popular sign because it was an attractive sign. Ben Johnson wrote a poem on inviting his friends to the Mermaid Tavern, and Shakespeare seems to have known the host of the Mermaid Tavern. He's connected with him in some deeds which survive when Shakespeare bought some property in the Black Friars in London.
So which is the older mermaid?
Well, the one in Bread Street, London, which was right near where Milton was born in 1608. That was where Shakespeare and Ben Johnson and their friends, Dunn and others, used to meet. And Ben Johnson describes the, in his poem on the memory of Shakespeare, he describes the great times they had at the Mermaid.
Just like to kind of, look at the broad picture now. You came again in 1935, and you remained active in the department, active in writing until until a couple of years ago. What are the biggest changes that you've seen in scholarship or at the university in your long career here?
Well, it's a much bigger university than it used to be, and so it's more varied, and they have different approaches, and it makes it interesting to have such a variety. In the 60s particularly, we had the first woman chairman, Helen White, and the first chairman in American literature, Walter Rideout, both excellent chairmen. And then we had in 65 Merton Seeltz in American literature, Lawrence Dembo in contemporary American literature, Jerome Taylor in Chaucer in medieval literature, and Phil Harth in the 17th and 18th century. So this has allowed us to give many different, more courses and more different kinds of courses, because the more extensive your department, the more varied the options for the students to choose from.
We talked last time about the first three professors in American literature here. The first one was, what was his name?
Well, I didn't know William Cairns, who died before I came.
Okay.
But Harry Clark was the one.
Clark
was the one I knew best.
Clark, and then Hoffman,
and then Henry Pockman.
And then Hoffman.
Yes.
The one we didn't talk about, and let's talk about him for a moment or two, because you've mentioned him a few times today, is Rideout, Walter.
Yes.
Rideout.
Well, Rideout was a very good chairman. I wasn't familiar with his scholarly work particularly, which was on 20th century novel, but he was well liked, and very helpful to the department. We did a good deal of traveling while we were still teaching, for example, we went right after I retired from teaching and my wife retired from her work as editor at the University Press. We went to Scandinavia and took a bus tour through Denmark, Sweden, and Norway. And that was very interesting because there was a small group of 16 people, but they came from 5 different continents, from North and South America, Africa and Asia, and Australia. And the driver was from Denmark, and the guide was a very capable woman from Norway who spoke good English. So we had a very interesting time there. We enjoyed that.
I have to ask you, how did you ever get hooked up with all those different people?
I just heard in Madison about the travel agency in Bergen, Norway that ran these bus tours, and it turned out to be such a happy experience that I recommended to various friends that I met later on. Then we later spent a week in the Caribbean at Tortola in the British Virgin Islands, but we spent a longer time in China with a Smithsonian tour. Mm. And there we flew to Beijing and saw the palaces of the emperors in China, mm, and also Tiananmen Square with Mao's tomb. We've had a visit to the Great Wall, and then we flew to Xi'an, where they dug up the terracotta statues of 600 soldiers that were buried, mm-hmm, as a guard for a Chinese emperor 2,000 years ago. And by chance, they were discovered by a peasant digging in his land about 30 some years ago. And they were very well preserved and repaired, so that you can see all these soldiers. Everyone has a different facial expression, and they were quite individual characters. Then we went to a city in China where we had 1,000 statues of Buddha carved in the rock of a mountain. We went down the Grand Canal on a boat, and we visited other cities like Suzhou and Shanghai, where we had a Chinese feast of 21 courses. So we had a very good time, and very interesting. And I was especially interested because my mother was born in China at Kalgan near the Great Wall. And her father, my grandfather, Mark Williams, was a missionary for 50 years, from the time he first sailed there in 1866 to the time he went back to China but died on the Pacific before he reached it in 1920. And I edited his autobiography after I retired, because he had written an account of all his life, and also an account of his escape from the Boxers in 1900, when many missionaries were killed, but he and other missionaries escaped past China into Mongolia, and they got a camel caravan, and they either rode camels or walked. They took turns walking through Mongolia until they got to Siberia and were able to come back home via the Trans-Siberian Railway to St. Petersburg, and then sail back to the United States. So that was something I enjoyed doing because I'd known my grandfather.
Okay.
Four children, 3 of whom live near Washington, where my son is a lawyer, and one lives near Harvard, where she's a librarian. We have 11 grandchildren, one of whom is an admissions officer at Johns Hopkins University. And one is a granddaughter is a professor of American history at Vanderbilt in Nashville. She's coming next month because her husband is finishing a PhD in Madison in June. And we have 7 great-grandchildren, the last of whom was born 3 days ago in Denver. We have spent a good deal of time, I think I've said, in Door County on the beach on Lake Michigan, where we live near Jacksonport in the summer, and all our children come and visit us there, and we've enjoyed that very much too.
Well, Door County is a lovely place to spend summer.
And we usually drive around all the cities from Sister Bay to Fish Creek and Ephraim and Bailey's Harbor.
You ever have an ice cream sundae at Wilson's Drugs?
Yes. Right, Ephraim, a very popular place, yes.
What's the other one? The Al Swedish Pancake House.
Yes.
Pancakes. Do you have any other comments?
I don't think anymore, no.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for this most interesting interview. End of interview.